members of the Commonwealth Club of California, thank you for your attention. I have been asked to announce that our speaker next Friday will be Jack Foisy, military correspondent of the San Francisco Chronicle, who will speak on the subject American troops in Vietnam. If I were to undertake in introducing our speaker of today to recount for you his career, I would be trespassing on his time and I'm afraid insulting your intelligence because he is so well known. Suffice it to say that our speaker is a native of California, a lawyer, a naval officer, a statesman, a congressman, senator, vice president of the United States, presidential candidate, a diplomat and world traveler, having represented his nation with distinction in over 50 foreign countries, both friendly and unfriendly. He is also a pianist of accomplishment. He is an orator and also an author. He is now practicing law in Los Angeles, and as a sideline or avocation, he is presently seeking employment in our state government. He will speak. He will speak to us today on California, Showcase for the Nation. It is my privilege to present the Honorable Richard M. Nixon.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Mr. President, members of the Commonwealth Club and their guests, I first want to express my appreciation to Burnham Anderson for a very generous and concise introduction. You would think that after all the things I have done that I would have been more successful than I have been in my political life. After all, I was a pianist and I knew the Missouri Waltz and learned it at one time. I was in the Navy. As a matter of fact, I was in the South Pacific. But I never got in a PT boat. That's why I'm here rather than in Washington. In fact, in figuring out why I am here, I find that I was a member of the wrong organization, or at least seeking the top office in the wrong organization. In talking to your president, I got a little of his background. And I said, what were you before you were president? He said, I was vice president for 2 years, and look what happened to him. I have had the opportunity of addressing this organization on several different occasions. And on each of those occasions, my privilege and responsibility was to speak on national and international affairs. Today, I come before you in a different capacity and speaking on a different subject, but on a subject which is related, certainly, to the national and international problems in which the members of this organization are vitally interested. I would like to get immediately into the substance of what I have to say by pointing out a fact that all Californians are aware of. At the end of this year, we shall be first in the nation in population. As we become first in the nation in population, California has an opportunity and a responsibility to lead the nation, not only in its numbers, but in public opinion, in the quality of our state government, in many other areas. There's no question in my mind about our ability to give that kind of leadership. We have here great natural resources, tremendous human resources. We have some of the great institutions from the standpoint of intellectual achievement in all the world, attracting from the eastern universities and colleges, people of the highest quality. We're hearing a great deal these days. The question is, will California meet this responsibility. And that is the burden of my remarks today. I believe that California has the chance, as it becomes first in the nation in population, to be a showcase to the nation, a showcase of leadership in which out of the West will come influence that the East, the Midwest, the rest of the United States needs to feel and hear from this great dynamic part of our country. Now I would like to point to some recent developments which indicate to us the nature of the challenge and how we can contribute to meeting it. Last November, New York, a state that will soon be second to California in population, repealed a clause in its constitution that declared all land grants given by the King of England to be null and void after October 14, 1775. In Michigan, as a result of the 1959 debacle that brought that state to the brink of bankruptcy, 144 delegates are presently convened in what is called the CONCON, or Constitutional Convention. And so great is the interest in that convention that the man who heads it is a potential candidate not only for governor of Michigan, but of the presidency of the United States. Tennessee has recently reorganized its government to eliminate 6 boards and commissions. And the newest state, Hawaii, streamlined its state administration in 1961, abolished 323 jobs. This development, therefore, is nationwide. All across the nation, people are concerned about the reorganization of their state governments and their state constitutions. I think there's a reason for this attitude, and the reason is that Americans are worried about the trend toward, let's let Washington do it. And part of the reason for this trend is that our state governments, bogged down as many of them are in archaic restrictions and outmoded systems of management, have simply created such a void in servicing the people that the federal government has often been forced to move in. Now that the pendulum of government has swung so far toward Washington, Americans see the very serious dangers involved. We know, for example, that government that is closest to the people is generally more efficient, less costly, and more responsive to the people's needs. We all recognize that Washington cannot know a state's needs as well as those at home. Washington brings a 50-state impersonal solution to a problem, not an individually tailored program for California or Michigan or New York. And this is not the most damaging result of the trend toward Washington. Much more fundamental is the way it warps our basic fabric of government, the constitutional principle of federalism, which is so essential to the preservation of freedom. Thomas Jefferson stated this principle in its first instance. Abraham Lincoln reiterated it. Republicans and Democrats through the years have paid homage to it. The principle that decentralized power is essential to freedom. It is not only the local touch that we have lost along the route to Washington, but something far more important: self-reliance, individual responsibility, local responsibility, which is related to that. And so now America says it's time for a change. It's time to streamline state government. It's time to bring to it the vast experience we have gained in businesses, universities, and civic groups. It's time to resume the responsibility of our state's welfare and our state's future. The answer, in other words, and the best answer and the most effective answer to more government from Washington is better government in California. Now, for a moment, I would like to turn specifically to the problem we confront in California. The growth of California's government has resembled Jack's magic beanstalk. By the end of World War I, there were already more than 100 independent offices, boards, and commissions. The standard operating procedure whenever a new problem of a special interest arose was simply to add another box on the organizational chart. This process clouded lines of authority, slowed down decision-making, skyrocketed the cost of government. As a result, California today even before it becomes the first nation in population, has the most expensive state government in the nation. By 1961, the governmental atom had been split so many times that if the governor were to spend just one day annually reviewing the work of each state body, he would barely have time to make the rounds in a year, for there were 360 separate boards, commissions, and agencies in the state government. Recognizing the seriousness of this situation, the governor in 1961 submitted a reorganization plan, which was passed in a slightly different form by the legislature. The governor's solution was to create a super cabinet of $25,000 a year administrators. Now, what did it do? The legislative analyst, A. Allen Post, estimated that as far as cost is concerned, it would be in excess of $250,000 without considering the additional technical staff or related operating expenses. But even more important, apart from the cost, the governor's plan failed to do away with a single agency of state government. On the contrary, it added another layer on top of the existing bureaucracy. Under the new plan, the super administrators have no power to affect any changes in their departments. They cannot consolidate a single agency. They cannot abolish a single board. They cannot eliminate a single job. And so, lacking this authority, it is plain to see that the super administrators cannot affect any economies in our state government, either in budgeting or in programming. In fact, what has happened is that the super administrators have direct access to the governor, but no operating authority, while their subordinates have operating authority, but limited direct access to the governor. The end result, therefore, of the 1961 reorganization has been additional problems of diffused authority, inadequate coordination, and poor communications. And the tragedy of this is that the need for revitalized government is greater in California than in any other state in the nation. I have already indicated that we have the most expensive state government in the nation. This means that also our local and state per capita tax burden is the highest in the nation. California, which grows at the rate of 1,600 persons each day, cannot stand pat on that kind of performance. We must create 20,000 new jobs each month just to tread water, and Californians are not used to, and we do not intend to tread water on this or any other problem. We want to be more than the biggest. We want to be the best. And as the first state in population, we want to lead the nation in the quality of our state government, not in its cost, not in its inefficiency, not in its tax burden. What then can we do about it? I believe that we must immediately undertake a long-range 10-point program to give California a more efficient, a less costly, and a more responsive state government. First, our Constitution must be revised. It now meanders for 245 pages. The index takes just 60 pages. It not only contains 256 amendments and over 75,000 words, it's the only constitution with an Article 4, Section 25, Section 25 and a half, Section 25 and 5/8, and Section 25 and 3/4. In short, it is a case of verbosity on a rampage. This might be merely ludicrous if it were not for the fact that words interfere with the deeds. Because by freezing into our basic government document all the solutions to past problems, we are putting a straitjacket on our ability to solve future problems. Second, we must streamline the swarm of state commissions, state bureaus, state agencies, and state departments. It isn't enough to put a shiny tin weather vane on top of an old barn. We must replace the rotten rafters and the sagging floorboards. There must be a statesmanlike reorganization of our executive branch of government to give the people of California more and better services for their tax dollars. For example, we cannot afford the wasteful duplication of having four separate agencies keep personnel records on every state employee and 7 separate state agencies collecting taxes. Third, I believe we must get rid of the super administrators, the unnecessary and expensive state-paid press agents, and all other surplus baggage that is accumulated in our state government. Governments exist to perform needed services and not to provide needless jobs. Fourth, we must make maximum use of our career employees as well as our elected officials. For example, in this connection, I believe that the lieutenant governor should be authorized to conduct year-round investigations into the operation of government agencies and make recommendations for cost-cutting and efficiency to the governor. Fifth, we must reapportion the state Senate so as to give an adequate legislative voice to the metropolitan centers of this state and yet at the same time maintain the majority representation from primarily non-metropolitan rural areas. Sixth, we must have annual general sessions of the state legislature so that legislation can carry over from one year to another. The constitutional requirement to hold budget-only sessions in even-numbered years has caused an erosion of legislative responsibility. The governor, who was forced to call special sessions during budget years, now has total control over legislative agenda. What happens in these special sessions is that he is the only one who can determine what is an emergency. And in the past, we have seen such emergency matters as legislation concerning cooking in hotel bedrooms on the call for the special sessions. Annual general sessions over a 2-year period will permit long-range, in-depth committee investigations with no fear of 2-year delays on issues of major importance. Seventh, we must unfreeze the 2/3 of the state budget that is not subject to legislative review or control. In the state's current $2.9 million budget, only a little over $900 million are subject to legislative scrutiny. We cannot have true fiscal responsibility until these mandatory appropriations and earmarked funds are exposed to the legislative searchlight. Next, we must initiate what I would like to call a California crusade for new business investment. I cannot cover it in detail here today, but our business leaders, in cooperation with our public officials, must forcefully take our case to the country. We must adopt tax and other fiscal policies that will help us to attract new industry to California. And again, going back to our relationship to the state of New York, we find that the per capita tax burden in New York today from state government activities is $129, and that in California is $141. It is easy to see the effect on the potential investor in making a choice between these two great markets and industrial states. We must reverse the trend that now sees some out-of-state industries passing over California in the search for new plant sites. Next, we must also have better coordination of those state and private activities that will make California's industrial and agricultural products competitive in foreign markets. I have personally seen the worldwide industrialization that now threatens not only the United States generally, but California products in particularly abroad. This 20th century industrial revolution is a great challenge to us in this country and in this state. We must respond by making our products household words in places that were once only exotic names on a map. This is a job primarily for private enterprise, but it is one in which the officials of our state government can provide leadership and guidance and also effective programming. And finally, the Department of Finance should be relieved of its petty responsibilities for such things as janitorial and grass-cutting services in order effectively to concentrate on planning for the overall growth of the state. There is no important single appointed officer, as far as the governor is concerned of this state, than the Department of Finance. That officer is one who not only has responsibilities as far as the budget is concerned, He also can assume responsibilities as far as overall planning is concerned. And consequently, any duties which are not basically essential and important should be removed from his responsibility. Each state function cannot be performed in a vacuum. The decision as to where to put a freeway determines more than future traffic flow. It determines future area congestion, which in turn determines future costs of doing business in California, which in turn determines the future economic health of our state. We must prevent highway planners or housing planners from starting a chain reaction without taking into account the ultimate length. It is time for the state government to look at the forest as well as the trees. The leadership for this kind of forward-looking planning must come from the governor and his top associates in the state administration. Besides these 10 proposals, during the past month, I have made other recommendations in the specific context of improving government activities in water development, in education, in dealing with communist activities in California. And in the months ahead, I shall point out other organizational changes that can give California more effective programs in cutting welfare costs, in dealing with the problems of agriculture, rapid transit, and other vital areas of state concern. However, I want to make it clear that as important and necessary as I believe these changes to be, they are not a cure-all for California's problems. Changing the structure of government does not automatically change the substance of government. Even the most streamlined operation will not guarantee success if the organization lacks decisive leadership, imagination, and drive. And therefore, the success of our state, just as the success of a business, depends on three factors. First, responsible and forceful leadership. Second, superior products, in this case, programs that adequately meet the needs of a dynamic and a growing state. And third, sound organization designed to keep costs down and production up. This is not, I emphasize, just the job of elected public officials. As citizens, and I don't need to say this to this organization, which has played such a significant part in this respect through the years, as citizens, we do not fulfill our responsibilities to ourselves and our state by casting a ballot and then standing pat until the next election. California's destiny will only be fulfilled by a progressive partnership of the private and public sectors of our state. I know that we can harness the energy of our citizens and our government to make California not only the biggest, but also the best in the United States. And together, we can make California a model of cost-conscious government with a conscience. I would like also to suggest that, as one who has been in government for 14 years, who has worked with legislatures of the opposite political party, I know some of the problems involved in these proposals that I have made. They are not easy. Some at the outset will be unpopular. There are many vested interests which will object to the basic changes that I have suggested. It will be much easier for those in positions of leadership, and particularly for political candidates, to let things drift, to sweep the problems under the rug. But I submit to you that this would not be worthy of our state, of our tradition, of the dynamism of California. And particularly, it would not be worthy of us at a time that we are first in the nation in population, and in which the nation naturally tends to look to us as an example for leadership rather than as an example of inefficiency and failing to deal with problems. In that connection, incidentally, I am well aware, just from looking at the program of the Commonwealth Club over the past few weeks and for the next few weeks, that the interests of an organization like this and of most organizations similar to this in America are now turned primarily to problems abroad and in the nation. I have had many people say to me, "Mr. Nixon, we can't get excited about the problems of local government or state government. After all, when we read the papers and see what is happening in Vietnam and in Laos or in Berlin or in outer space, Certainly, when we read the papers and see the tremendous concentration of power in Washington, D.C., as indicated by the president's action in handling the steel crisis, how then can individuals get excited in an election contest, for example, involving only problems of local or state concern? I have an answer for that today, related to what I have said. And I give this answer to that today not only because I happen to be seeking a position, but also because in this audience are two members of the state legislature, Don Mulford, Bill Bagley. They are representative of many others, holding positions in a legislative body which receive very little public respect in many instances and too little support in election contests because of a failure to realize the tremendous power and importance of the obligations they will have. I say to you, what is more important than the education of our children, than the development of our cities, than in the law enforcement, which will reduce California's crime rate, in developing our water and power resources? But if I could get really to the kernel of the problem, when we speak of this great world conflict in which we are engaged, we must realize that America will win in this competition with the Soviet Union without war only if we play our game and play it to the hilt. We will not win if we make the mistake of playing the game that our potential opponents have a lock on playing in their way. What I mean to say is simply this. We are confronted with a world power and with a man, Mr. Khrushchev, who says that the way to progress is through doing everything by government action. Our answer to this, therefore, must not be by giving up on individual and private enterprise and turning always and first to government, but by giving more power and more responsibility to private and individual enterprise. That is part of the equation. The other part is just as important. We are confronted with a world power whose philosophy is based on the assumption that where government action is involved, that action is most effective that is totally centralized in one great capital, Moscow. Our answer to that, as I've already implied, is not through centralizing more and more power in Washington, but through having more power and more responsibility in our state and local governments. This brings me back to my major theme expressed just a few moments ago. The answer, the positive answer, to those who are concerned about the drift of power to Washington, D.C., about Washington moving into education, Washington moving into urban planning, into all of these other areas, is not simply to be against what Washington does, but to be for positive action in the private sector of the economy to the extent that that is possible, and where that is not possible, to do the job effectively at the local and the state level. And we cannot do this job effectively unless we revitalize the organization of our state government. It is this message, therefore, that I bring to you today, recognizing that in this organization through the years, many of the proposals that I have made have already been studied and submitted to you, recognizing that they will not be adopted overnight, but recognizing that at the present time, there is, it seems to me, a vacuum. At the present time, there is, therefore, a responsibility for the first state in this nation to provide leadership, by saying, in effect, to the rest of the United States, we in this great dynamic West believe in individual and private enterprise as the primary source for progress. We in this state of California believe that when private enterprise can't do a job and it has to be done by government, we will do that job first at the state and the local level. And to prove that we mean what we say, we tackle the job now of revitalizing, reorganizing our state government so that it can do this job effectively at lower cost to the people of this state. This is the kind of leadership, it seems to me, that a group of opinion makers like those in this room can provide for this community and for this state as well as for the nation. We need reorganization of the state government of California to do the job. That is the thing to do, and the time to do it is now. This is the time to begin. And with your assistance, there is no question that California can provide the leadership in this vital area that not only California needs, but that the nation needs and wants as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nixon. The response of your audience has demonstrated far better than any words of mine could possibly do how deeply they appreciate your address. I shall now turn the meeting over to Hillary Crawford, president of the Commonwealth Club, who will conduct the question and answer period. Mr. Crawford.
For the benefit of those who are listening in on the air, I will say this, that we stopped the sale of the tickets at 1,000, and we have more than 1,000 here for lunch today. I have just received a telegram addressed to me as president of the club, which says this: please convey to your distinguished guest, the Honorable Richard Nixon, my warm best wishes and greetings to San Francisco. I greatly appreciated your kind invitation to be present today. And I wish it had been possible for me to join you, but owing to my campaign schedule, I must be in the southern part of the state. The Commonwealth Club is performing another outstanding service by bringing Mr. Nixon to your distinguished rostrum for a discussion of issues vital to your state. And I join with you in extending to him San Francisco's cordial welcome, signed George Christopher, Mayor of San Francisco. About a month ago, we had a distinguished candidate here. I won't tell you what his name was, but he's running for governor, and they furnished me a brochure that gave his background, and I took a look at it, and I saw there that he said that he was a member of the Commonwealth Club of California. I looked in our roster today, and I found there that there was a Richard M. Nixon of Washington, D.C., who was listed as belonging, and he joined in 1950, and he still belongs, and I take it that must be our distinguished guest. And without any reservations whatever, I predict that the next governor of California will be a member of the Commonwealth Club of California. Now, Mr. Nixon, if you will just come back to the rostrum, I have a sheaf of questions here about 2 inches thick, and we'll never get through them, but this is the first question. What do you consider as California's most pressing problem, excluding the incumbent administration?
California's most pressing problem, excluding the incumbent administration, I'm simply repeating the question, you understand, is... is the cost of our state government, which I have... attempted to highlight by my remarks, and the cost of our state government affects the other problem which concerns every Californian, the economic progress of this state. California needs to provide new jobs for our increasing population. We are not providing those new jobs at the rate which is necessary to close the job gap or the unemployment gap. I believe that this problem can become a very serious one if the potential investors in California gain the impression that not only is there no hope for cutting the expenses of state government and eventually reducing the burden of taxes in this state, but on the other hand, the certainty that if we do not make a change in the fiscal policies of this state, that within the next year it will be necessary to raise taxes in this state. In my opinion, that poses the major problem. And unless we get a change in attitude in Sacramento with regard to the cost of state government. That means cutting costs. It means, in my opinion, that we will be keeping from California new investment that we need to provide the jobs for our increasing population.
What percent of the vote will Shell get? How are the odds in Las Vegas?
Well, I'm not a betting man myself after what's happened to the stock market recently. And I can only say that I have never attempted to predict an election campaign in terms of the betting odds or in terms of the percentage of the vote. I will only say this, that I expect to be nominated on June 5th, and I expect the contest between then and November 6th to be one of the hottest, one of the best in California's history. And like all candidates, of course, I expect to win with your help.
Sometimes our members wander a little bit away from the subject. If you had been president of the United States last month, how would you have reacted to the U.S. Steel announcement of a price increase?
Well, having been involved in the settlement of a major steel dispute in 1959, I realized that it would be inappropriate for me to criticize what the union did or management did or the president did in specific terms. I will only say this. First, in peacetime, I do not believe that there is justification for government control of either prices or wages. Second, if there is to be government control of either prices or wages, there must be control of both. And third, if there is to be such control, it should be laid down by law and not be done by executive order and executive whim. One final point. If we were to take a poll of the United States of America and were to ask all citizens involved, do you favor wage increases, they would say yes. If you were also to poll the same people and say, do you favor action by the president or anybody else to keep down prices, they would say yes. This, of course, is the best of all possible worlds. What we have to realize, however, is this. And incidentally, what I'm now going to say is politically not popular, but it needs to be said. There's been a great deal of talk with regard to whether or not wage increases should exceed productivity increases. And the president, I think, very properly pointed out in his speech to a union audience recently that wage increases should not exceed increases in productivity. He, however, perhaps could have even gone further in this respect. Wage increases cannot continue to take up the whole productivity factor, because unless American industry is allowed to make enough of a profit that it can plow back into new equipment and new investment the necessary funds to pay double the wage that England pays, three times the wage that Germany pays, four times the wage that Italy and Japan pays, we are going to price ourselves out of the world market. And so what I am suggesting here is this, that we need economic sophistication, more knowledge on this particular instance. And what is needed here on the part of labor, on the part of management, and on the part of government is to recognize that America does have today, and we're proud to have it, the highest wage scale in the nation. We would like to have that wage scale to remain high and to go higher to the extent that that is feasible. But also we must realize that high profits are also necessary, high enough at least, to enable American industry to buy the new equipment to pay those higher wages so that our people can be more productive than the lower paid people abroad. It's as simple as that, and I think if we had a little more economic sophistication on that point, there would perhaps be less misunderstanding when individuals who are in the private sector of the economy and the management side say when a wage increase comes, we cannot pay it unless we also get a price increase which will enable us to remain competitive.
This man has no doubt as to what's going to happen. Will you call for a constitutional convention in California when you are elected?
This obviously is in reference to how we modify the Constitution. It can be done in several ways. The constitutional convention procedure was tried in 1935 and failed because the state legislature, as you know, has to take the first step, and in this case it got bogged down in the state legislative process. I would attempt to get at this problem through all of the methods that are available. And if this particular method failed, in other words, the state legislature was unable or unwilling to set in motion the machinery for the calling of a convention, we then could go to a second method in which the state legislature could move specifically on constitutional reforms of the types that I have mentioned. And on this way, while we would get only half a loaf, it at least would be a start on the problem. In any event, I am aware of the several different procedures. The Constitutional Convention one is a possibility which certainly should be considered. And having in mind the practical realities, if it is not successful, there are other ways to get at the problem.
This one's from a doctor. What of the King-Anderson bill tacking medical care for the aged on Social Security as compared with the Kerr-Mills bill based on needs?
I oppose the King-Anderson bill. I favor the Kerr-Mills approach. Without going into it in detail, I oppose the King-Anderson bill, which, as you know, provides that all individuals over 65 will, in effect, have Social Security be covered by health insurance. I say all individuals over 65. I should qualify that in this respect. The King-Anderson bill gives the impression to the public that if it is passed, every individual over 65 is going to have so-called free medical care. It does not provide that at all. It covers first only those people over 65 who are under Social Security, which leaves out 2 or 3 million people. In the second place, it does not provide for physician services. It does not provide for example, operations. It provides only for nursing home and hospitalization type of care. I believe that this kind of compulsory approach under Social Security for people over 65 will eventually, if that is adopted, be adopted for all people in the society. And while it has tremendous political appeal, everybody, I suppose, believes that his doctor bills are too high at one time or another, that he would like to have free medicine. I am concerned about the fact that in the United States today, with all of the weaknesses in our medical system, we still have the best medical care in the world. I don't want to reduce the standard of that medical care. I believe that any compulsory program which might interfere with a doctor-patient relationship would jeopardize the standard of medical care. Therefore, I say before we turn to a compulsory health insurance program of that type, let's give the Kerr-Mills Act, which takes care of people in need, a chance, because this, again, gets back to my basic philosophy. The easy thing in America to do when we have a problem is to turn completely to a big government program to solve it. That is not usually the right way. Our way is to try individual and private enterprise first, with the minimum of government necessary to do the job. That's why I prefer the Kerr-Mills bill and why I oppose the King-Anderson bill.
What are the first two state agencies you would abolish? That's loaded.
Well, I would say that in speaking of state agencies, I would start with the 9 super agencies that have been created by the reorganization bill. I would take all of those out. I believe that they're simply another layer of fat in effect in which the operating agencies are denied the access that they should have to the governor of this state. And having started with that many, I would then proceed to move on reorganization of the other agencies of government, consolidating where possible, abolishing where possible, and in this particular way, I'm pretty sure that we could do an effective job.
About half of their thoughts are on foreign affairs. This is a little bit off the subject. Will you comment on the president's handling of the new threat in Laos? You feel that a show of U.S. military strength is required there?
Every time I answer a question on foreign affairs, which inevitably comes up in one of these problems, the press gives that the lead And people then say, I'm not talking about state affairs. You're witnesses to the fact that I've talked on state affairs up to this time, please. Now, however, in that connection, let me say, I don't think the governor of California should be a provincial puppet. I think he should be an individual who knows about world affairs and who from time to time lets the people of the nation know what the people of California think about it. So I want to make clear, as far as anybody here is concerned, that my knowledge in the field of foreign affairs, of course, has been considerable. I am not going to discuss these particular issues when I do know nothing about them, but where I have an opinion, I'm not going to dodge them, and I'll begin right now. As far as this particular one is concerned, the President's action in Vietnam in sending American forces there and the President's action in Thailand is necessary, should be supported by the people, Republicans and Democrats alike. I would say further that it doesn't make sense for individuals to say we want to stand up against communism and then to refuse to give the President of the United States the tools that he needs to stand up against communism in a place like Vietnam and also Thailand. The third point that I would make is this. If I were to be indulged in any criticism at all, and this is probably criticism that would be directed more to the State Department than to the President himself, it would be with regard to the attitude toward Laos. Mr. Harriman suggested that we in the United States should support a coalition government in Laos with the communists as a method of settling that situation. A coalition with the communists is a sellout to the communists. History tells us that. History tells us that. It happened in Czechoslovakia. It worked that way in China. It is going to work that way in Laos. And I am glad now that the President, after apparently some, it seems to me, unfortunate policies at lower levels with regard to Laos, is saying that as far as Thailand, our ally, and Vietnam, our ally, that the United States will be strong. One last point. Many of my friends say, well, isn't that a warlike attitude? And the answer is absolutely not. The attitude in which we say we will not, in effect, stand up is the attitude that leads to war where the communists are concerned. And two examples out of President Eisenhower's presidency to prove the point. When we stood up in Quemoy and Matsu, we heard the same thing. We're going to get in a war over Two Little Rocks. If we hadn't stood up in there, we'd been in a war over Formosa. The same was true as far as Lebanon was concerned. We sent in the Marines there, and we heard a lot of talk to the effect, by moving in there, we're risking war. By standing up in Lebanon, we avoided war. It's this that the American people have to understand, and it's this, apparently, that the President of the United States is trying to get across, and he therefore deserves support.
We have time for just one more question. Honorable Richard M. Nixon, the Commonwealth Club of California, welcomes you back here as a longtime member. And we thank you for this most interesting session. And as soon as you have finished answering this question, this meeting will stand adjourned automatically. On the question of reapportionment, particularly in the State Senate, what is your formula?
This formula isn't going to satisfy anybody because everyone has his own. In my opinion, the reapportionment initiative is the best plan presently possible. While it is not a perfect solution, I have one, for example, that I think would be better. I think it is much better than the solution that the Governor's Blue Ribbon Committee laid down, and the best, certainly for that reason, the action that we can take at the present time. The Blue Ribbon Committee, as you recall, provided for 3 new senators for Los Angeles only. This was a nice political path for Los Angeles. On the other hand, it disregarded the fact that other metropolitan areas of this state had grown and that they too needed new representation if Los Angeles needed it. The reason that I think the initiative deserves support are these. First, it retains the traditional balance of power in the non-metropolitan areas. It provides for a Senate of 50. 30 of those senators will be from the non-metropolitan areas, 20 from the metropolitan areas. The State Senate should not be a carbon copy of the Assembly. Under this plan, it would not be, because the rural senators would still have a balance of 10. Second, as far as the 20 senators from the metropolitan areas are concerned, they split them, it seems to me, also on an equitable basis, not simply on population, but balancing the interests of one state and of the state against another. 10 of them come from the southern metropolitan areas, 10 from the north. And therefore, that will mean that in the Senate you will have an equal balance of representation from the Bay Area metropolitan centers and from the southern area, even though there is a greater population in the southern area. This, therefore, retains in the Senate the balance which is needed of seeing to it that areas are represented in the Senate not simply on the basis of population, but to protect their interests. It also provides the additional people that I think are necessary simply to do the paperwork and the other legislative work for the great metropolitan areas. Under these circumstances, I favor that reapportionment program, and I believe that it deserves the support of Republicans and Democrats alike.
This is Stuart Richardson Warren, and across the microphone from me sits the Honorable Richard M. Nixon, former Vice President of the United States and presently candidate for Governor of California. Mr. Nixon, in talking to the Commonwealth Club now, you referred to the fact that soon, at the end of the year, that we in California will be second to New York in, will be first in population to New York State. And you referred in the course of your talk today to the club to the changes which you envisage will ensue because of that new status in part. You referred to the fact that Americans, in your judgment, are worried about the trend towards let Washington do it, as you expressed it. And you suggested that Washington brings a 50-state impersonal solution to a problem, and you were in favor of self-reliance. I was reminded of Ralph Waldo Emerson's remark about trust yourself, every heart responds to that iron cord. Is that the sort of thing you have in mind, Mr. Nixon?
I certainly have. I don't have the immediate literary background to remember the Emerson quote, but I think it could be very appropriately applied to the philosophy I think all Americans are deeply devoted to if they think things through, and that is that the way to progress in this country is through relying primarily on individual responsibility and individual self-reliance, than in giving up on responsibility by the individual and turning everything over to government.
And referring to California's government, Richard M. Nixon, you said that the standard procedure had been by some other leaders here in the state, whenever there was a new problem, to just add another box. Now, in your judgment, how is this, shall we say, boxing of the compass of public affairs succeeded as regards California's welfare?
Well, it has succeeded in this respect. It has created so many agencies in the state government that at the present time we have probably one of the most inefficient governments in the nation. And in order to prove that, I refer to the cost. California is still second in New York to population. We will be first at the end of this year. But we are already first in the expensiveness of our state government. And we are already first in the per capita state and local tax burden in California. Now, this to me is clear proof of the fact that our state government is costing us more than it should. And therefore, I believe that we've got to look at all of these agencies that have grown up like Topsy, reorganize them, cut them down, not cutting down the services that they render, but giving better service with less money.
Supposing, Mr. Nixon, that somebody should say that in making a statement, that sort of a general statement, that you were not specific, would you have any specific suggestions in mind?
Yes, I have a number of specific suggestions that I outlined in my talk today. First, we have to bring our Constitution up to date. It is a document which at the present time freezes into the Constitution solutions of old problems, and therefore denies us the ability to tackle new problems as we should. A second thing that we need to do is to bring into state government capable people who will have as their motivation not finding how they can do a job with the most people and at the greatest expense, but how they can render the service at the least possible cost. In that connection, this brings me to a third point that is very important. We, at the present time, have our state budget frozen as far as two-thirds of it is concerned because of constitutional inhibitions. Only one-third of the state budget is subject to the will of the legislature and to the recommendations of the governor. Therefore, I think we've got to unfreeze the state budget so that we can act effectively in reducing expenditures and putting our money where it will do the most good and render the greatest service.
Going back to your suggestion as to a revision of the Constitution, as you know, as an attorney, Mr. Nixon, the attorneys in many cases like to have something which has been adjudicated and ruled upon by the Supreme Court so they know where they are. And you also know, of course, what Mr. Bryce, in his famous book on Constitution, said, that your California Constitution was a rag bag. Would you feel that by changing the Constitution around and revising its terms that you would create any confusion in judicial matters?
For a time, yes. But this should not, of course, keep us from making the change. We have to look at our Constitution, and in those respects where it is an instrument not of providing methods for progress, but an instrument for the status quo where we need progress, we have to make the necessary changes.
Would you have, in view of the sociological developments, perhaps we might say, in both the national, the state, and even the international scale as to human relationships, that there are things that have human values which might be introduced into the Constitution or handled perhaps in a better way?
Well, this is a very good question because I have noted oftentimes that whenever anybody refers to organizing the state government more efficiently and cutting the costs of state government, that the reaction instantly is, well, that individual is only concerned about money, that he is selfish, that he isn't concerned about people, that the problems of people are what we ought to be concerned about. And I think it's well to lay that one to rest once and for all. I happen to have grown up in a family where we had a relatively small house and where we knew what property taxes were and all taxes. I recognize that in the state of California today, there are literally millions of people of modest income who, from the standpoint of their taxes are concerned, both the state and federal taxes, have a burden which is greater than it should be. For example, the per capita tax in California today is $141 as compared with $139 in New York. Now, therefore, I say that an individual who, before he approves a new government program, asks the question, how much will it cost, and can I do it for less, is interested in human values. He's attempting to help not only solve the problems of the state budget, but he's trying to help the family solve the problems of the family budget. And I would also say in that connection that when we consider these questions of human values, we want to remember that it isn't a question of which government spends the most as being the best. In many instances, and in most instances, as a matter of fact, we will find that better services can be rendered to the people by government which spends less. So I am glad to get a chance to nail this misconception with regard to the role of government and who, frankly, is for the people and who is against the people.
You suggested, Mr. Nixon, that you would favor two-year sessions of the state legislature and that you would have the matter of investigatory processes going on all the time by the lieutenant governors. Of course, we have in the United States, as we both know, a principle of fixation of responsibility as being very essential and important. Could it be said that you were passing the buck if you should make that sort of an arrangement with respect to the lieutenant governor making investigations?
Matter of fact, what I would be doing with the lieutenant governor is exactly the same thing in a different way that President Eisenhower did with me as vice president. The vice president traditionally simply presided over the Senate and had a few perfunctory duties to perform. President Eisenhower recognized that as the only other elected official, he ought to be doing more. And consequently, I did troubleshooting jobs in the government and all over the world. The lieutenant governor of this state is in somewhat a similar position. He is an elected official. He has great prestige. And I think as the agent of the governor, he can get out and make the investigations that the governor, because of his duties, couldn't make. And his investigations would have immense impact. And therefore, by having a close working relationship with the governor, they would be able to make some progress in reducing the costs of state government while at the same time improving the services of state government.
Of course, it's another axiom of business that you're either going ahead or you're going backwards. In fact, that's true in so many things in life. What would you say as to this materialistic sort of thing, business, and the commerce on which, the back of which, shall we say, all of us ride, particularly those in the cities?
Well, as far as business is concerned, and I simply think that...
I had my new business particularly, Dick.
Yes. I think particularly... that we have to recognize that in California, we are going to be first in population, but we're also going to be first in a number of problems as a result of that population increase. We need more jobs for that increasing population. And at the present time, partly as a result of California's high tax burden and the prospect of even higher taxes in the future, we're not getting enough new business in this state to provide enough jobs. Now, what's the answer? Some people say, well, the government ought to provide the jobs. That's the wrong answer, because that means that we're abdicating on individual responsibility. The way to progress in this state is through getting more jobs in private, individual enterprise. That's what's made California great. It will make it greater in the future. And so I would say, as far as business is concerned, one of the reasons that a new administration, which will cut government expenditures, avoid a tax rise, and eventually provide the funds with which you can have a tax cut, will serve the interests again of this individual whom the budget cutter is supposed to be against. What is more important to a family? What is more important than a job? A job with which you can buy the shoes and the groceries and the clothing and provide for the housing. And I would say that a wasteful kind of a state government that has no concern about the tax burden is working against the interests of the average person far more than any kind of a government could work against it. And I say that an individual or a public leader who advocates cutting the costs of government so that we will get new business that will provide jobs for our people is rendering the greatest possible service that he could to the average individual as far as his welfare is concerned. This is true welfare, the kind of welfare that individuals want, where they get a job, where they can take care of themselves and handle their own problems.
Over the years, we both remember that whenever governmental costs have been suggested in the state, all the governors of my recollection have pointed out the fact that a very high percentage of the costs of the government are fixed. As you just said, they are frozen in the Constitution. Now let's take a look at the other side for a minute, Dick Nixon. Supposing they unfreeze those costs, and as you well know, that would include the public school system, which is pretty close to all of us, what would be your attitude on that matter of redistribution or reassessing of the responsibilities for such costs as education?
Well, taking education specifically, what we have to realize is that at the present time, one of the major problems is the new bedroom community, so-called. Literally, millions of people in California now live in what we call tract houses, in communities in which there is great wealth, but wealth in terms of people and not in terms of taxable property. These people also have great numbers of children. And here's where we have the overcrowded classrooms. Today, California, for example, is 46th on the list as far as crowded classrooms are concerned. Only six states are worse than we are. How do we deal with this? Well, we simply have to find a way whereby the state either gives more to these districts so that they can provide the schools and the other services for these bedroom communities, or we've got to change our tax system so that those particular communities can have the tax base to do that job. This is a tough one because the richer communities aren't going to like that. But on the other hand, everybody in the state of California has a vital concern in seeing that every youngster has an equal chance at an education. And that's why this kind of a program, again, is one that deals with the welfare of the people in the broadest sense.
From the floor, Dick Nixon, you recall that you were asked today, although it was not a state matter, what you thought about the present situation as of today in Vietnam and the Southeast Asia. Do you feel that the governor of California should take an interest, perhaps, in affairs of that kind?
He certainly should. California now looks to Asia. It's the first state in the nation. And the governor of California, rather than being a provincial puppet, claiming and being proud of ignorance on international affairs, should speak out for the people of this state when he has some views on that. And I would say in this connection, I'm glad to speak out as far as my own views are concerned. I believe the president is right and that he should have the support of the American people, regardless of party, support in sending the forces to our allies, Thailand and Vietnam, which will stop communist aggression there. This will not lead to war. It's the only way to have peace in dealing with the communists, because if we do not send the forces there, the communists will move in, and then we will have to move in as we had to move into Korea. So I support President Kennedy's position in this respect.
They certainly moved in on you with some tough questions today, Dick. One of them was, if you're going to economize, what you're going to do to the wages of public employees? That was a good one.
As far as the wages of public employees are concerned, I believe that those wages certainly should not be reduced, and as a matter of fact, that they have to be on the upturn in order to remain competitive with private enterprise. But here again, I point out you cannot expect any real action with regard to paying adequate wages, not only to our school teachers but other public employees, until you get efficiency to get rid of the freeloaders and the fakers and the others that are on the public payrolls. And I would say that the honest, hard-working government employee has the greatest stake in getting rid of that type of people.
Thank you very much, Richard M. Nixon, candidate for governor of the state of California. And now may I announce that next week, same time, same station, I'll be interviewing for you Mr. Jack Foisy, San Francisco Chronicle military writer, on the topic American Troops in Vietnam.